We liked to tease each other, but our jokes rarely, if ever, involved Julian.
"You and Liam are very close, aren't you?"
said Ruth, looking at me.
"Well, we're doing well, yes. The poor boy needed a strong father figure, from what I hear."
"How do you mean?"
"Well, after what his real father did. Alice was lucky that she met a real man in the end."
"Ah," I said.
"I prefer a masculine man. Don't you, Alice?"
"I do," said Alice. "Me too," I said.
"It takes a big man to take on another man's child,"
said Peter, slapping a hand down on his knee.
"Especially the son of a gay homosexual. No offence, Alice. I meant your ex-husband. No. I admire you, Cyril. I really do. I don't think I could have done what you did."
"No offence taken," said Alice, beaming from ear to ear.
"All I can say is that it's a good job Liam didn't turn out like his father," continued Peter. "Do you think that sort of thing runs in families?"
"Ginger hair can," said Ruth, "so it's a possibility."
"Will you tell them, or will I?" I asked, looking at Alice. "Oh, I don't think either of us should," she said. "Let's hear what else they have to say. I'm enjoying this."
"What's that?"
asked Ruth.
"Alice tells us that you're a wonderful violinist," said Peter. "I play the ukulele myself. Have you ever played the ukulele?"
"I haven't," I admitted. "Nor have I ever played the violin."
"Oh, I thought that's what you said he played, Alice," said Ruth. "Is it the cello?"
"No, it's the violin," said Alice. "But you're thinking of my husband, Cyril, who plays in the RTE Symphony Orchestra. This isn't him. This is my ex-husband, Cyril. Don't you remember meeting him before? I thought you realized. It's been a few years, I suppose."
"Cyril 1, I said, to clarify things. "Where is Cyril 2, anyway?" I asked, turning to Alice.
"Don't call him that, and he's at home putting the dinner on."
"Woman's work," I said. "I prefer a masculine man."
"Shut up, Cyril."
"Am I still invited?"
"If you promise not to run away before we serve the meal."
Hold on there,"
said Peter, looking back and forth between the pair of us.
"This is your ex-husband, is that right?"
"Correct," I said. "The gay homosexual."
"Oh, but you should have told us," said Ruth. "We never would have said such things if we'd known that you were the gay homosexual. We thought you were Alice's second husband. You're quite alike, the pair of you, aren't you?"
"They're nothing alike," cried Alice. "Cyril, too, is a lot younger, for one thing, and much better looking."
"And a straight heterosexual," I added.
"Well, we can only apologize. We'd never say such things to a person's face, would we, Peter?"
"No," said Peter. "No hard feelings. It's all forgotten."
"All right," I said. "Of course, I should have realized," said Ruth, laughing. "Now that I look at that jumper you're wearing, I suppose I should have guessed."
"Thank you," I said, glancing down at myself, uncertain what my jumper had to do with my sexuality.
"It's like Christmas morning here with all the compliments."
"Oh, wait, it is Christmas morning." "Am I right in thinking that you work in the Doll?" asked Ruth.
"That's right," I said, "in the library."
"Now that must be very interesting. Do you get to see any of the TDs of the ministers?"
"Yes, of course," I said. "I mean, that's where they work, after all. I see them most days wandering around the place in search of drinking companions."
"What about Bertie? Do you ever get to see Bertie?"
"Yes, quite often," I said.
"What's he like?"
"Well, I don't really know him," I said, "other than to say hello, that is. He seems friendly enough, though. I've had a drink with him in the bar a few times, and he's always full of chat."
"I love Bertie," said Ruth, putting a hand to her chest as if she needed to control her palpitations.
"Do you?"
"I do. I don't mind at all that he's divorced."
"That's good of you."
"I always say that he's a fine figure of a man."
"I always say that, don't I, Peter?"
"Ad nauseam,"
said her husband, reaching down and picking up a book that he had left on the table between us, the latest John Grisham. I wondered whether he was going to start back into it now.
"You should hear her, Cyril. All day long it's Bertie this and Bertie that. She'd run off with Bertie if she could." Whenever she sees him on the television, it's like watching a teenage girl at a boys' own concert.
Oh, don't be ridiculous, said Ruth. Bertie's a lot better looking than any of those lads. The thing is, Cyril, Peter doesn't like politicians. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Labour. They're all the same as far as Peter's concerned. Crooks.
Scumbags, said Peter. That might be going a bit far, I said. It's not going far enough, he said, raising his voice. I'd string them all up if I could. But you never got the urge to take a machine gun into work and just blow all those politicians away.
I stared at him, wondering whether he was joking or not. No, I said. No, I don't. The idea has never crossed my mind, to be honest.
Well, you should think about it, he said. That's what I'd do if I worked there.
Cyril will be putting the turkey in the oven around now, said Alice.
Cyril too, I said, clarifying things for Peter and Ruth.
Don't call him that. We're going to our eldest boy's for dinner, said Ruth. Joseph. He works for an animation company, if you can believe it.
We don't mind. It takes all sorts.
He makes lovely roast potatoes, though, doesn't he, Peter? He hasn't taken a wife yet, even though he's 35. I think he's very particular.
Her husband looked at her and frowned, as if this was a matter that needed deep thought.
His roast potatoes, he said, would stand comparison with those of a Michelin-starred chef. I don't know what his secret is. He didn't get it from me, that's for sure.
Goose fat, said Alice. That's the trick. Peter couldn't boil an egg, said Ruth.
I never needed to, he protested. I had you for that.
Ruth rolled her eyes at Alice as if to say men. But Alice refused complicity and glanced at her watch instead. It was just coming up to noon. Your daughter is a credit to you, I said, changing the subject. She's a wonderful mother to young George.
Well, we brought her up properly.
A door to her right opened, and a nurse walked out, and we all turned our heads in anticipation, but she walked away from us towards the nurse's station, where she gave an almighty yawn before leaning down to peruse a copy of the RTE guide.
I wonder what would make a man want to be a gynecologist, said Peter in a thoughtful voice,
and Ruth threw him a look of warning.
Be quiet, Peter, she said.
I'm only saying. Laura's gynecologist is a man, and I think it's a funny job. Looking at unspeakables all day. A 14-year-old boy might think it was fun, but I could be up to it. I was never a big fan of looking at woman's unspeakables.
Am I right in thinking that you're a psychiatrist, Alice? Asked Ruth, and my ex-wife shook her head. No, she said. I'm nothing of the sort.
What made you think that?
But you're a doctor. That's right, isn't it?
Well, yes, a doctor of letters. I teach literature at Trinity College. I'm not a medical doctor.
Oh, I thought you were a psychiatrist.
No, said Alice, shaking her head.
I actually considered cardiology for a while myself, said Peter. It was my specialism, I mean.
Oh, are you a doctor?
I asked, turning to him.
No, he said, frowning. I work in construction. Why do you think that?
I stared at him. I had no answer.
Peter and I actually met in a hospital, said Ruth. Not the most romantic place in the world, I suppose. He was a porter, and I was in to have my appendix out.
I reeled her down to the operating theatre, said Peter. Well, I thought there was something very attractive about her as she lay there under the sheet. After they put her under, I stayed to watch the operation. When they took the sheet off her, I took a look at her body and said to myself, that's the woman I'm going to marry.
Right, I said, telling myself not to look at Alice in case her expression would make me laugh. And how about you two? Asked Ruth.
And now we did exchange a look.
How did you two meet?
We'd known each other since we were children, I said.
Well, not quite, said Alice.
We met when we were children, once, when I ran screaming out of Cyril's house. And we didn't even meet then, to be honest. Cyril just saw me, that's all.
But why did you do that? Asked Peter. Did he do something to upset you?
No. His mother frightened me. It was the only time I ever met her, which is unfortunate, because she ended up being my particular field of study. Cyril's mother was a brilliant novelist, you see.
Adoptive mother, I said.
But anyway, we met again when we were a little older.
Alice's brother was a friend of mine, I said carefully.
Is this the brother who helped out with Liam? She asked.
Yes, said Alice. I only had one.
This would be the lad who died over there in America, would it?
Asked Peter, and Alice turned to him and gave him a brisk nod. He'd obviously heard the full story.
Christ, you haven't had an easy time with it either, have you?
He asked, laughing a little.
You got it on both sides.
Got what? Asked Alice coldly.
Well, you know, your brother and your...
He nodded towards me.
Your husband here, your ex-husband, I mean.
Got what, though? She repeated. I don't understand what you're talking about.
Don't mind, Peter, said Ruth, reaching across and placing her hand on Alice's, somewhere between a caress and a slap.
He thinks before he speaks.
I'm in trouble again,
said Peter, looking at me with a grin,
and I began to wonder whether he was trying to be offensive or was simply an idiot. There was another extended silence, and I glanced down at his book.
What's that like?
I asked, nodding at the John Grisham.
It's not bad, he said. Your people read a lot, don't they?
My people?
Your people.
Irish people, do you mean? Sorry, I thought you were Irish too.
I am,
he said blankly.
Oh,
right, I said. Did you mean gay homosexuals?
Isn't it awful how that word has been co-opted to pursue the liberal agenda?
Asked Ruth.
I blame Boy George.
Yeah, said Peter. That's what I meant.
Right, I said.
Well, I suppose some do and some don't, like anyone else.
Here,
said Peter, leaning forward and grinning at me.
Bear to your John Major. Which one would you rather have as your boyfriend? Or would it be Clinton?
I bet it would be Clinton.
I'm right, am I?
I'm not really looking for a boyfriend, I said. And if it was, it wouldn't be one of them.
It always makes me laugh when fellows use that word, said Ruth. And true to her word, she started laughing.
Boyfriend!
It'll be something new for you all the same, said Peter. A baby, I mean.
It will, I agreed.
The traditional family. Whatever that is, I said.
Ah, you know what it is, said Peter. A mammy and a daddy and a few kids. Look, Cyril, don't get me wrong. I don't have anything against your lot. I'm not prejudiced at all.
He's not, agreed Ruth. He's never been prejudiced. Sure, he had a whole load of darkies working for him back in the 80s before it was even fashionable. And he paid them almost as much as he paid the Irish workers. We even had one in the house once.
She leaned forward and lowered her voice.
For dinner,
she added.
I didn't mind.
True enough, said Peter proudly. I'm a friend to every man, black, white or yellow, gay, straight or homosexual. Live and let live, that's my motto. Although I have to admit that lads like you baffle me.
Why is that? I asked.
It's hard to explain. I just never understood how you can do the things you do. I couldn't do it.
I don't suppose anyone would want you to, I said.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, said Alice, poking me in the ribs. Peter's a good-looking man for his age. I'd say they'd be lining up. You have the look of Bertie Ahern, if you ask me.
He looks nothing like Bertie, said Ruth wistfully.
Thank you, Alice,
said Peter, pleased by the compliment.
You don't have any gay children yourselves, then? I asked, and they sat bolt upright in shock, the pair of them,
as if I'd taken out a stick and started to beat one or other of them senseless with it.
We do not,
they said together.
We wouldn't be the sort, added Ruth.
What sort is that?
I asked.
It's just not the way I was brought up, or the way Peter was brought up, she said.
But your son Joseph makes lovely roast potatoes, is that right? What has that got to do with anything?
Nothing, I was just saying. I'm getting hungry, that's all.
Can I ask you, said Ruth, leaning forward. Do you have a partner?
I shook my head.
No,
I said.
No,
I don't.
Have you always been alone?
No, I said. There was someone once, a long time ago, but he died.
Do you mind if I ask you? Was it AIDS?
I rolled my eyes.
No,
I said. He was murdered.
Murdered? Asked Peter.
Yes, by a group of thugs.
Sure, that's even worse.
Is it? Asked Alice. How so?
Well, maybe not worse. But no one asks to be murdered, do they?
No one asks to get AIDS, I said.
Well, maybe no one specifically asks for it. But if you're going to ride your bicycle on the wrong side of the street, you can expect to get knocked over. Am I right?
No, you're completely wrong, snapped Alice. And if you don't mind me saying so, that's a very ignorant thing to say.
I don't mind at all, Alice, said Peter. Speak as you find, and I'll do the same. That way we'll stay friends.
It's attitudes like that that cause so much trouble in the world, she said. We could always eat in the hospital canteen, I suppose, said Ruth, interrupting her.
What?
If we get hungry, I mean. We could eat in the canteen.
Sure, the food there is even worse than the rubbish they serve the patients, said Peter.
Would we not be better going over to Joseph's and having our dinner with him there and coming back when we get the call? We should eat his roast potatoes while they're fresh. And you know, he wanted us all to watch The Sound of Music in the afternoon. It's Stephen's favourite film.
Who's Stephen? I asked.
His flatmate, said Peter. They're great pals. They've been sharing for years.
Right, I said.
No, we would not, said Ruth. You won't be able to drive, for one thing.
Why wouldn't I?
Because I know what you're like, Peter Richmond. You'll get started on the red wine, and that'll be the end of it. I won't get a word of sense out of you, and there'll be no taxi drivers on the street later. They'll all be at home with their families. She paused for a moment and put a finger to her lip. It must be terrible to be murdered, she said, turning back to me. I'd hate it.
The door opened again, and now Liam appeared, wearing similar blue scrubs to those that the nurse had worn earlier. Turning and seeing us all waiting, we stood up and he grinned, holding his arms out wide.
I'm a dad, he said. Again.
We all cheered and embraced him. I was touched that when he threw his arms around me, he seemed to squeeze me extra tight, and when he pulled away, he looked directly into my eyes and smiled.
And how's Laura? Asked Ruth anxiously. Is she all right?
Not a bother on her.
They'll be bringing her up to her room in about half an hour, and you can see her then.
And the baby?
Asked Alice.
A little boy, he replied.
You'll have to try for a girl next time, said Ruth.
Steady on, said Liam. Give us a chance.
Can I see him? I asked finally. I'd love to hold my grandson. Liam looked up, and his face broke into a smile of pure happiness as he nodded.
Of course he can, Dad, he said. Of course he can.
Julian, too. Laura's parents left first, looking forward to Joseph's roast potatoes and Stephen's rapturous appreciation of The Sound of Music. Alice left shortly afterwards, but I told her that I was going to stay with Liam for a little while longer, and that I'd take a taxi to Dartmouth Square and be there before Cyril, too, was ready to carve the turkey.
You're not going to not show up, are you? She asked, looking me directly in the eye with all the coolness of a trained assassin.
Why wouldn't I? I asked.
You do have form in this area, Cyril.
Not fair. I always show up.
I just don't always stay until the end.
Cyril?
Alice? I'll be there, I promise.
You better. Because if you don't, Inyak, Rebecca and the children will be very disappointed.
And so will I. It's Christmas Day, after all.
I don't want you hiding out in Balls Bridge on your own. The whole family should be together. And I've bought a massive box of Quality Street.
Well, that seals the deal.
And every flavour of Pringles. I hate Pringles. And I'm planning a game of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire later. I even bought a book.
Even so, I'll still come. As long as I can be the question master.
No, Cyril too wants to be the question master. Don't call him that. Oh, shut up, Cyril.
I just feel like spending a little more time with Liam, that's all.
And it would be nice for you and your young man to have an hour together before I arrive.
You can kiss and do all sorts of man and woman dirty things with each other. Oh, for fuck's sake.
You can wax his strings.
Cyril, tighten his bow.
I'll swing for you in a minute. By the way, I was planning on getting completely sloshed tonight and staying over. I assume that's all right.
If you don't mind sleeping in your childhood bedroom and hearing your ex-wife have sex with a man 5 years younger than you while five infants scream their heads off, then it's fine with me.
Sounds delightful. I'll be there by four. Promise.
And so I spent another half an hour with my son and his wife. And before I left, I brought Liam down to the hospital cafe, where we bought two bottles of beer and toasted the latest addition to our unconventional family.
It was very kind of you, I told him, feeling a little emotional now. Partly because I was a grandfather again, partly because it was Christmas Day, and partly because I was looking forward to the evening ahead. To invite me in to meet the baby first, I mean. I'm not sure that I've earned that right. I would have thought your mother or Laura's parents.
I don't care about all that stuff anymore,
he said quickly. I've put all that behind me.
That's good to hear. But still.
Look, he said, putting his bottle down. Cyril.
Dad. It doesn't matter, okay?
I know I wasn't the easiest person to get along with when we first found each other, but things are different now. You've done nothing since we first met but make me like you, despite my best efforts. And it's quite annoying, actually, because I was determined to hate you, and I was equally determined to love you, I said.
You know I had to do it, don't you? He said eventually.
Do what?
His name. My son's name.
I guessed that you might, I said. I hoped that you would.
It's not a slight against you. I never thought for a moment that it was.
You and your uncle had a close bond, and you loved each other. I respect that.
And my relationship with him was just as deep as yours, only different.
I loved him very much.
Our relationship was a complicated one, and I didn't come out of it covered with glory, but then again, neither did he. Still, we were together from the start. We went through a lot together.
And we were by each other's side at the end.
To my surprise, Liam buried his face in his hands and started crying.
What is it? I asked, reaching out and taking his hand. What's wrong?
I still miss him so much, he said. I wish he was here.
I nodded. And the lesser part of my character allowed myself to feel envious, knowing that my son would never love me as much as he had loved Julian.
Did he talk about me? He asked. When he was dying, I mean. Did he mention my name?
I felt the tears form in my eyes now, too.
Are you kidding me?
I asked.
Liam, you were the son he never had. He talked about you all the time at the end.
He wanted you there, but he didn't want you to see him as he was.
He loved you so much. You were the most important person in his life. He lifted his bottle.
To Julian, he said, smiling. It took me a moment, but I lifted my bottle too.
To Julian, I said quietly.
And to this day, I don't know which Julian we were each toasting, Liam's beloved uncle or his newly born son. A little hunchbacked redemptorist nun. As I made my way back towards the ground floor, my phone rang and I glanced at the screen, knowing exactly what it would say. Alice.
You have 1 hour, she said, without any preamble when I answered. I'm leaving now. 1 hour and then I lock the doors.
I'm literally walking out of the hospital as we speak. The twins are asking where you are.
Which twins?
Both sets.
Impossible, I said. One set are only babies. They can't even speak, let alone question my whereabouts.
Just be here, said Alice, and stop annoying me.
How's Cyril too? Is he cracking under the pressure of cooking for so many people? 58 minutes and counting.
I'm on my way.
I hung up and made my way towards the exit, but the sound of weeping coming from behind a set of doors to my left gave me pause. I glanced over to where the doors to the chapel were ajar. The room inside seemed so different to the rest of the hospital, the clinical white walls replaced by something warmer and far more inviting, that I found myself moved to take a closer look. There was only one person inside, an elderly lady seated at the end of a pew halfway towards the altar. Classical music was playing softly, a piece I half recognized, and the door to one of the confessionals was open. I watched the woman for a few moments, uncertain whether I should walk away and leave her to her sorrow or see whether she needed some help. Eventually my feet made the decision for me, but as I stepped closer, my eyes widened in surprise at who she was. "Mrs. Goggin?" I said. "It's Mrs. Goggin, isn't it?" She looked across at me, as if woken from a dream, and stared at me for a few moments, her face pale. "Kenneth?" she said. "No, it's Cyril Avery, Mrs. Goggin," I said. "From the Dáil Library." "Oh, Cyril," she said, nodding her head and putting her hand to her chest, as if she was afraid she might be having a heart attack. "Of course. I'm sorry. I took you for someone else. How are you, dear?" "I'm fine," I said. "It must be years since I saw you last." "Is it that long?" "Yes, it was at your retirement party." "Oh, yes," she said quietly. "But what's wrong?" I asked. "Are you all right?"
"I'm not, no," she replied. "Not really."
"Is there something I can do for you?"
She shrugged.
"I don't think so," she said. "But thank you anyway."
I glanced around, hoping that one of her family members might be nearby and come in to help, but the chapel was silent and the doors had closed shut behind me.
"Do you mind if I sit down for a few minutes?"
She took a long time to decide, but finally nodded her head, moving over a little in the pew to let me join her.
"What's happened, Mrs. Goggin?" I asked. "What has you so upset?"
"My son is dead," she said quietly.
"Oh, no. Jonathan?"
"A couple of hours ago now. I've been sitting here ever since."
"Mrs. Goggin, I'm so sorry."
"We knew it was coming," she told me with a sigh. "But that doesn't make it any easier."
"Had he been ill for long?" I asked,
reaching across and taking her hand in mine. Her skin felt paper thin, and there were dark blue veins running towards her knuckles.
"On and off," she said.
"He had cancer, you see. He first developed it about 15 years ago, but he managed to beat it then. Unfortunately, it came back late last year, 6 months ago. The doctors told us there was nothing more that they could do for him. And today was the day.
I hope he didn't suffer too much."
"He did," she said. "But he was very stoical about it. It's those of us who are left behind who'll have to suffer now."
"Would you like me to leave you on your own, or is there someone I can call for you?"
She thought about it, and dabbed the corners of her eyes with her handkerchief.
"No," she said.
"Can you stay a little while, if you don't mind?"
"I don't mind at all," I told her.
"You don't have anywhere to be."
"I do, but it won't matter if I'm a few minutes late."
"But is there anyone from your family here to take care of you? You're not all alone, surely?"
"I don't need taking care of," she said defiantly.
"I might be old, but you have no idea the strength that's left in this body."
"I don't doubt it," I said.
"But you're not going home to an empty house, are you?"
"No. My daughter-in-law was here earlier with my grandchildren. They've gone home now. I'll follow shortly."
"All right," I said, remembering the woman and the two little girls whom I'd seen wrapped in each other's embrace earlier when I'd first arrived at the hospital.
"I think I noticed them in the corridor upstairs a couple of hours ago."
"You might have done. They were here all night. Well, we all were.
A terrible way for children to spend Christmas Eve. They should be waiting for Santa Claus, not watching their daddy die. I don't know what to say to you, I said, looking towards the front of the church where a large wooden cross holding the crucified Christ stood in the wall, looking down at us in all his pity. Are you religious? I asked. Do you find some peace in here at least? I'm not really, she said. I have some sort of relationship with God, I suppose. But I had a bad time with the church when I was a girl. Why, are you? I shook my head. Not even slightly. I don't even know why I came in here, to be honest. I was just passing, that was all, and it looked quiet. I needed somewhere to sit, that's all. The church was never a friend to me. I've always felt that the Catholic Church has the same relationship to God as a fish has to a bicycle. I smiled. I feel the same way, I said. I don't even come into churches very often, except for weddings and christenings and funerals. More than 50 years ago, a priest picked me up by the hair and threw me out of my parish church, and I haven't had much time for it since. But I should have asked you why you're here, she added, turning to look at me. Something must be wrong if you're in a hospital on Christmas Day. No, it's nothing like that. My son and his wife had a baby boy earlier today. I came in to see him, that's all. Oh, well, that's good news at least, she said, forcing a smile. Do they have a name for him yet? They do. Julian. That's unusual, she said, considering it. You don't get many Julians these days. It makes me think of Roman emperors, or the famous five. One of them was a Julian, wasn't he? I think so, I said. It's been a long time since I read those books. And how are things in the doll? Oh, you don't want to worry about that. Today of all days. I do, she said. Just for a moment. It will take my mind off things. Well, they're much the same as ever, I said. Your successor is running the tea room with an iron fist. Good for her, she said, smiling. I trained her well, so. You did. If you don't keep those TDs in line, they'll walk all over you. Do you miss it? I asked. I do and I don't. I miss the routine. I miss getting up every morning and having a place to go and people to talk to. But it's not as if I ever particularly enjoyed the job itself. It was a living, that was all. Something to put food on the table. I suppose I feel the same way, I said. I don't need to work, but I do it anyway. I don't look forward to retirement. That's a long way off for you yet. I shrugged my shoulders. Less than a decade, I said. The time will fly. But look, let's not talk about me. Will you be all right, Mrs. Coggan? I asked. I will, in time, she said carefully. I've lost people before. I've known violence. I've known bigotry. I've known shame, and I've known love. And somehow, I always survive. And I still have Melanie and the girls. We're all quite close. I'm 72 years old, Cyril. If there is a heaven, then I suppose it won't be long before I see Jonathan again, too. But it's hard to lose a child. It's an unnatural thing. It is. An unnatural thing, she repeated. And he was your only one? No. I lost another son a long time ago. Oh, Christ, I'm sorry. I didn't realize. It was completely different, she said, shaking her head. He didn't die. I gave him up. I was pregnant, you see, and just a girl. Different times, of course. That's why the priest threw me out of the church, she added with a bitter smile. They have no compassion, do they? I asked. They talk about Christianity, and yet it's just a concept to them, not a way of life at all. I heard afterwards that he had fathered 2 children himself by 2 different women, one in Drimaleague and one in Clonakilty, the old hypocrite.
He wasn't the one who...
Oh, my lord, no, she said. That was someone else entirely.
And what about the child? I asked. Have you never been tempted to find him?
She shook her head.
I watch the news, she said. I've seen the documentaries and films. I dare say he would blame me for whatever went wrong in his life, and I haven't the energy for that. I did what I thought was right at the time, and I stand by my decision. No, a little hunchbacked, redemptorist nun took him away from me, and I knew that day that I would never see him again, and I've made my peace with that over the years. I just hope he was happy, that's all.
All right, I said, squeezing her hand, and she looked at me and smiled.
Our paths seem to cross every so often, don't they? She said.
Dublin is a small city, I told her.
It is.
Is there anything I can do for you? I asked.
No. I'll go back to Melanie's now. And what about you, Cyril? Where are you going for your Christmas dinner?
To my ex-wife's house, I said, and her new husband. They take in all the waifs and strays.
She smiled and nodded. It's good that you can all be friends, she said.
I don't like to leave you here on your own, I told her. Would you like me to stay with you a little longer?
Do you know, she said quietly, I think I'd prefer to have some time to myself. After a while, I'll get up and go. I can get a taxi outside. But you were very good, Cyril, to come in and say hello to me.
I nodded and stood up. I'm very sorry for your loss, Mrs. Goggin, I said.
And I'm glad to hear that you have a new grandchild. It was nice to see you again, Cyril.
I reached down and gave her a kiss on the cheek. The first time I had done such an intimate thing with her, and turned back down the aisle, making for the door. As I left, I looked back and saw her sitting upright on the seat, staring at the crucifix. And it struck me that here was a strong woman, a good woman, and what kind of God was it who would allow her to lose one son, let alone two? I was out in the corridor again before a sentence that she had spoken came back to me, bursting through my brain like a shot of electricity. A little hunchbacked redemptorist nun took him away from me, and I knew that day that I would never see him again. I stopped still and reached out to the wall for support, leaning heavily on my crutch with the other arm. Swallowing hard, I turned around and looked back at the doors of the chapel. "Mrs. Goggin," I said, walking through them again and calling out to her. She spun around in surprise and stared at me.
"What is it, Cyril?" she asked. "Do you remember the date?"
"What date?"
"The date your son was born."
"Of course I do," she said, frowning. "It was in October 1964, the 17th. It was a..."
"No,"
I said, interrupting her. "Not Jonathan. I mean your first son. The one you gave up."
She said nothing for a moment, simply stared at me, perhaps wondering why on earth I was asking her such a question. But then she told me.
She remembered it quite clearly, of course.
2008. The Silver Surfer. Aquabatics with Alejandro. Arriving at Houston Station, I glanced up towards the departures board, but had to squint to make out the platform from which our train was scheduled to leave. For weeks, I had been feeling both excited and apprehensive about the trip ahead, a journey that I'd never imagined either of us taking. And now that the day was finally here, I was nervous about the emotions that it might stir up in us both. Looking around, I saw my 79-year-old mother marching through the front doors, apparently full of energy as she wheeled a suitcase behind her, and I made my way over to take it from her, reaching down to give her a kiss.
"Get away," she said, dismissing my offer of help. "I'm not giving my bag to a man with a crutch."
"You are indeed," I said, wrestling it off her. She gave in, and when she looked up at the departures board, I could tell that her eyesight was better than mine. On time, I see, she said. What seldom is wonderful. It was a constant source of amazement to me that she was so sprightly. She didn't even have a regular doctor, insisting that she didn't need one because she never got sick. "Were we bored?" I asked, and tried to get a good seat. "Lead the way," she said, following me down the platform. And I walked towards the most distant carriage, the one that had the least chance of being crowded. There were groups of young people and parents with small children climbing into the nearer ones, and I wanted to be as far away from them and their noise as possible. "You're like an old man, Cyril," said my mother, when I made this observation to her. "I am an old man," I said. "I'm 63. "Yes, but you don't have to act like one. I'm 79, and I went to a disco last night." "You did not." "I did so." "Well, a dinner dance, anyway, with some friends." When I finally found a carriage that suited me, we climbed on board and sat down at a table facing each other, windows next to both of us for the view. "It's good to get off my feet," she said with a sigh. "I've been up since 6. "Why so early?" I asked. "I went to the gym first thing."
"I'm sorry?"
"I went to the gym," she repeated. I blinked, uncertain whether I was understanding her right.
"You go to the gym?" I asked.
"I do, of course," she said. "Why don't you?"
"No."
"No," she said, glancing at my stomach.
"Well, you should try it, Cyril. Losing a few pounds wouldn't kill you."
"Since when have you been going to the gym?" I asked, ignoring this.
"Oh, for about 4 years now," she said.
"Did I never tell you about it?"
"No,"
I said. "Melanie signed me up for my birthday when I turned 75. I go 3 times a week now. One for a spin class, one for cardio, and one for acrobatics with Alejandro."
"What on earth is acrobatics?" I asked.
"It's a bunch of old ladies in the pool shaking their booties to pop music."
"What's a booty?
And who's Alejandro?"
"He's a 24-year-old Brazilian trainer."
"Oh, Cyril, he's lovely. When we all behave ourselves, he gives us a treat and takes his shirt off. It's a good job we're all in the pool, as we'd need to cool off."
"Jesus," I said, shaking my head in a mixture of bewilderment and amusement.
"There's life in the old dog yet," she said, winking at me.
"I don't think I want to know."
"Actually, I think Alejandro might be gay too," she said.
"Like you,"
she added,
as if I'd forgotten that I was one.
"I could introduce you if you like."
"That would be great," I said. "I'm sure he'd like nothing more than to be introduced to a man old enough to be his grandfather."
"Perhaps you're right. He probably has a fella anyway."
"Well, you could always just come along to acrobatics and perv over him like the rest of us do. It's open to anyone over 60.
"Please, don't use that word, Mum," I said. "It sounds really creepy coming out of your mouth."
She smiled and looked out the window as the train began to move. We had a couple of hours' journey ahead of us to Cork City, followed by a bus to Bantry, and then I planned on hiring a taxi for Gulleen from there.
"So anyway," she said, "have you any news for me at all?"
"Not much." "I bought a new vase for the front room."
"And you're only telling me now?"
I smiled.
"It's a nice one," I said.
"And did you go on that date?"
"I did," I said. "What was his name again?"
"Brian."
"And how did it go?"
"Not well."
"Why not?"
I shrugged. I'd spent the previous Thursday evening in the front lounge with a man in his 50s, who had only come out of the closet after 34 years of marriage a few weeks earlier. None of his children were talking to him, and he spent the entire evening bemoaning this fact before I found an excuse to leave. I hadn't the energy for any of that.
"You need to get out more," said my mother. "Go on more dates."
"I do occasionally," I said. "Once a year." "Once a year is enough for me.
Anyway, I'm happy as I am."
"Do you go into the chat rooms at all?"
"Excuse me?"
"The chat rooms," she repeated.
"What chat rooms?"
The ones where gay men meet other gay men. You send pictures to each other and say the age and type of man you're looking for, and if you're lucky, is this a joke? I asked. No, it's very popular among the gays, she said. I'm surprised you haven't heard of it. I shook my head.
I think I'll stick to the old-fashioned way, I said. How do you know so much about this stuff, anyway?
I'm a silver surfer, she said.
A what?
A silver surfer, she repeated. Oh, I'm very with it, you know. I take computer classes in the ILAC Center every Wednesday afternoon with Christopher.
Does he take his shirt off for you, too?
Oh, no, said my mother, shaking her head and grimacing. And I wouldn't want him to either. He's a bit of a minger.
You've been hanging out with your grandchildren too much, I said.
Now that you mention them.
Did I tell you that Julia has a boyfriend now? She asked, referring to her eldest granddaughter.
Does she indeed? She does. I caught them shifting each other in the living room last weekend. I said nothing to her mother, but I sat down later and told her to be very careful and keep a hold of her happiny. One fallen woman in the family is enough.
What's shifting? I asked.
Oh, come on, she said, rolling her eyes. Are you alive at all, Cyril? Are you living in the 21st century?
I am, I protested. I imagine it's some form of... I hesitated with the words. Some form of sexual activity, is it?
No, it's just kissing, she said.
But I suppose it can lead places.
Young people can lose the run of themselves, and she's only 15. Although he seems like a nice lad, from what I can tell. Very polite. He looks like he could be one of those Westlife fellas.
If I was only 60 years younger, I'd have a go myself, she added with a laugh.
Anyway, how's work?
Are we missing much on the doll?
Not much, no. It's fairly quiet. I'll be ready for my retirement when it comes. You can't retire, she said, shaking her head. I won't allow it. I'm not old enough to have a retired son.
I've only got 2 more years, I said. And then that's it.
Do you know what you'll do then?
She asked me. I shrugged. I might do a little bit of travelling, I said, if I have the energy. I'd quite like to see Australia, but I don't know if I can be doing with a journey at my age.
A friend of mine from the Silver Surfers went to Australia last year, she said. He has a daughter in Perth.
Did he have a good time?
No. He took a heart attack on the plane and had to be shipped back from Dubai in a coffin.
Great story, I said.
Encouraging. Ah, well, he should never have gone. He'd had 4 heart attacks already. He was an accident waiting to happen. He was very good with spreadsheets, though, and email. I think you should go.
And take me with you.
Really? I said.
You'd be interested in seeing Australia?
I would if you're paying, she said with a wink.
It's an awful long way to go.
They say first class is very comfortable.
I smiled. I'll think about it, I said.
We could see the Opera House, we could, and climb the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
You can. I don't like heights. And they wouldn't let me up with a crutch anyway.
You're old before your time, Cyril. Did anyone ever tell you that?
The train pulled into Limerick Station, and a young couple got on and sat at the 2 seats across the aisle from us. They looked as if they were in the middle of an argument, and were sitting on it for the time being so as not to be overheard by an audience. She was clearly fuming, and he was sitting with his eyes closed, his hands clenched into fists. An inspector walked past, checked their tickets, and when he moved on to the next carriage, the man, who was about 30, reached into his backpack and pulled out a can of Carlsberg. Holding the can with thumb and third finger, he popped the ring pull, and a spit of foam flecked up onto his girlfriend's face.
"Do you have to?" she asked. "Why shouldn't I?" he said,
picking up the can and taking a long slug from it.
"Because it would be nice if, just for once, you weren't drunk by 6 o'clock.
You'd be drunk every day, too," he said, "if you had to put up with you."
I looked away and caught my mother's eye, who was biting her lip and trying not to laugh.
"And you can't smoke on here," said the woman, glaring at him when he took a pouch of tobacco from his bag and a packet of Rizzlers. "It's a train."
"Is it?"
he asked.
"I thought it was a plane, and I wondered why we were still on the ground."
"Fuck off," she said.
"You fuck off," he replied.
"You can't smoke in here," she repeated, raising her voice now. "I'm not smoking," he insisted. "I'm just rolling them for later."
He shook his head and looked across at me before glancing at my mother.
"Have you had 50 years of this?"
he asked me, and I stared back at him. Did he think my mother was my wife? I didn't know what to say, so simply shook my head and turned back to look out the window. "The trains are very comfortable these days, aren't they?" said my mother, pretending that none of that had happened at all. "They are," I said. "Not like in my day." "No? Of course, it's years since I was on a train. And when I left Gullin first, I took the bus, not the train. It was all I could afford." "That was where you first met Jack Smoot, wasn't it?" I asked. "No, it's where I met Sean McIntyre. Jack was waiting for us at the other end." She sighed a little and closed her eyes for a moment as she travelled back in time. "Have you spoken to Jack lately?" I asked. "About a month ago. I'm planning my next trip over." I nodded. We'd told each other almost every detail of our lives, but had always avoided mentioning one particular night in Amsterdam almost 30 years earlier. It seemed easier not to talk of it, even though we both knew that we'd been there. "Can I ask you a question?" I said. "Of course," she said. "What is it?" "Why did you never go back?" I asked. "To West Cork, I mean. To Gullin, back to your family." "Sure I couldn't have, Cyril. They threw me out." "No, I know that. I mean later on, when tempers had softened." She raised her hands in an uncertain gesture. "I honestly don't think anything would have been different, even if I had," she told me. "My father was not a man to change his mind on anything. My mother wanted nothing to do with me. I wrote to her a few times, but she never replied. And my brothers, except perhaps for Eddie, were always going to side with Daddy because they each wanted the farm when he was gone and didn't want to get on the wrong side of him. And, of course, Father Munro would have chased me out of town on the back of a donkey if I dared to show my face. And your father? Well, your father was certainly never going to help me." "No," I said, looking down at the table and scratching away at a mark there in a nervous gesture, one that took me back in time to the Dáil tea room many years ago with Julian Woodbead. "No, I suppose not." "And the second reason," she continued, "was an even more basic one. Money. It wasn't easy to travel in those days, Cyril, and what little I had I was saving in order to be able to survive. If I wanted a holiday, I took a couple of days in Bray, or if I was feeling adventurous, maybe I went as far south as Gorey or Arklow. And then, in time, I started going to Amsterdam every few years. The truth is, Cyril, that I never gave it much thought. Once I was gone, I mean. I never thought about going back. I never wanted to. I put it all behind me, until today." "Fair enough," I said. Another noise from across the aisle, and I stared at the young couple who, without my noticing, had moved seats so they were sitting next to each other. He had his arm around her now, and she was leaning into his shoulder, her eyes half shut in tiredness, as he reached down and kissed the crown of her head. At that moment, they looked like a picture postcard. "Give it an hour," I thought. "Give it one shake of the train on the tracks, and they'll be at each other's throats again." "Young love," I said, smiling at my mother as I nodded my head in their direction. "Been there," she said with a shrug and a roll of her eyes. "Done that. Bought the T-shirt." Kenneth. We'd waited a few weeks to meet again after that day in the hospital chapel. It was possible, of course, that it had been pure coincidence, that the use of that phrase, a little hunch-backed redemptorist nun, was just chance. Could it have been hers at first, and somehow been adopted by Charles and Maud, as if it had travelled across the city along with my small body? Or had Charles just thought the same thing, and these had been the obvious words to use? And even the date of birth could have been happenstance. How many children, after all, were born in Dublin on the same day each year? And yet somehow I knew immediately that this was no coincidence, that we had been in each other's lives all these years without even realizing who the other one was. But of course, our timing was terrible. My mother had just lost one son. She wasn't ready to deal with the implications of potentially finding another only a few hours later. She grew terribly upset when I sat down and told her what I suspected. And finally, I had no choice but to call her daughter-in-law, whose number the hospital gave me, and dispatch her in a taxi home. Afterwards, I waited a couple of weeks to write to her. I didn't attend Jonathan's funeral as much as I wanted to, making it clear that I needed nothing from her and that I was not one of those unfortunate souls seeking retribution for my abandonment many decades earlier. I simply wanted to talk to her, that was all, and for us to get to know each other in a way that we hadn't to date. And in time, she replied. "Let's meet," she said. "Let's meet and talk." And so we met in Boswell's Hotel, across the road from Dáil Éireann, one Thursday evening after work. I could barely keep still all day, so anxious was I about what lay ahead. But once I crossed the road, I began to feel strangely at peace. The bar was fairly empty, save for the Minister of Finance, sitting in a corner of the room with his head in his hands, apparently weeping into his Guinness, and I turned away from him, not wanting to get involved with whatever madness was going on over there. I looked around and saw Mrs. Goggin, as I still thought of her, sitting on the other side of the room, and gave her a wave as I approached, and she smiled back, nervously. She had a cup of tea in front of her that was almost empty, and I asked her whether she wanted another.
"What will you be having?" she asked. "Will you be having a drink?"
"I might have a pint," I said. "I have a thirst on me after the day's work."
"Then perhaps you'd be good enough to get me one, too."
"The pint?" I asked, surprised. "Of lager?"
"Of Guinness," she said.
"If you don't mind, I might need it." Somehow it made me happy that we were both going to be drinking. It would take the edge off, I decided.
"Sláinte,"
I said when I returned, lifting my pint. And she lifted hers too, and we clinked glasses, failing to look each other in the eye, as one is supposed to do at such moments. I didn't know what we were expected to do next, and for a while we sat quietly, making small talk about the weather and the condition of the soft furnishings.
"Well, now," she said at last.
"Well, now," I repeated.
"How have you been?"
"As well as can be expected."
"It's a terrible loss that you've suffered."
"Yes. And your daughter-in-law and the girls?" She shrugged.
"They're remarkably strong, all of them," she said. "It's the thing I most admire about Melanie. But I hear her at night, crying in her bedroom. She and Jonathan loved each other very much. Of course, they were together since they were just teenagers, the pair of them, and he should have had many decades ahead of him yet. But then, you know what it is to lose someone too young, don't you?"
"I do," I said. I had told her about Bastian many years earlier when she was still employed in the tea-room.
"Does it ever get any easier?" she asked.
I nodded.
"It does,"
I said. "You reach a point where you realize that your life must go on regardless. You choose to live, or you choose to die. But then there are moments, things that you see, something funny on the street or a good joke that you hear, a television program that you want to share, and it makes you miss the person who's gone terribly. And then it's not grief at all. It's more a sort of bitterness at the world for taking them away from you. I think of Bastian every day, of course, but I've grown accustomed to his absence. In some ways it was more difficult to get used to his presence once we started going out."
"Why is that?"
she asked.
"Because it was new to me," I said, considering it. "I messed up everything when I was young.
So when I finally found myself in a normal, healthy relationship, I wasn't sure how to deal with it. Other people learn those tricks so much younger."
"He left them very well provided for, all the same," she said. "Jonathan, I mean."
"So there's that to be grateful for. And Melanie is a wonderful mother.
I've been living there since Christmas, but it's time I went back to my own place. I'm going back next week, in fact.